Okay, moving on to agenda paper 5C.
Yes, thank you. So agenda paper 5C discusses a matter relating to the application of IFRS 1 when a subsidiary adopts IFRS standards later than its parent. More specifically, whether the subsidiary is permitted to measure cumulative translation differences at the amount that will be included in the parent's consolidated financial statements based on the parent's date of transition to IFRS. At the March meeting, the committee discussed the matter and tentatively decided not to add this matter to its agenda because it concluded that the current requirements provide an adequate basis for a first-time adopter to determine how to account for cumulative translation differences. We received four comment letters, which are reproduced in Appendix B. Three respondents agree with the committee's technical conclusions. The other respondents suggest that, considering the purpose of the exemption in paragraph D16, it might be possible to interpret that paragraph differently. All four respondents recommend that the board consider amending IFRS 1 to extend the exemption in paragraph D16 to cumulative translation differences. Paragraphs 9 to 16 of the paper discuss the application of the existing requirements. Based on the analysis, we continue to think that the exemption in paragraph D16 applies only to assets and liabilities. Paragraphs 17 to 39 of the paper discuss whether the board should undertake standard setting to extend the exemption to cumulative translation differences. Based on the analysis, on balance, we're not entirely convinced that the benefits of amending IFRS 1 in this respect would justify the cost of doing so. Consequently, we recommend that the committee finalize its agenda decision. The question for the committee is on page 9 of the paper and asks whether you agree with the staff recommendation to finalize the agenda decision. With that, hand over to the committee.
I think that was a good comment here from Japan saying that it should be possible to interpret this in a positive way, to include this possibility to also reset this CTD then. And I realize that that will not be any big in favor for that then. But I think we should do this small amendment to the IFRS 1 then do an annual improvement in this regard, as we did propose here just earlier on this tax issue.
Okay, Bonnie?
So I think I have two overall comments. One is, if we are going to consider a change, I think we address all of OCI, not just CTA. Because otherwise you're carving out a small piece that I think missing maybe the rest, which could also be a challenge. I also think there's probably a bit of an underestimation of the practical challenges of moving a subsidiary, moving to IFRS with the intent of harmonizing with the parent's basis in order to ease the burden of accounting for differences from a statutory perspective. And if you're just adding differences, this plus there could potentially be other differences, I think that kind of is a negative in terms of providing an opportunity to move towards IFRS from an efficiency standpoint on the subsidiary side. So I agree with where the staff has got to, but if we're going to consider a change, we either do all of OCI or none of it.
Some scope difference. Okay. Bertrand?
I would favor also trying to amend IFRS 1. I think it could be a good thing to propose a third option to companies that might be dealing with those issues. And I will have a in-the-middle view between Mike and Bonnie. Probably probably suggesting that we could restrict the amendment to to recycled OCI, because it's probably where it would limit then the scope of the amendment first. Probably it would be it would you mentioned your resource issue, which I perfectly appreciate and perfectly understand. So maybe it would also ease things in these matters. And then actually probably the most important aspects of this option would be for recycled OCI. Non-recycled OCI, I think, will never go to P&L. So I'm not sure this specifically needs to be dealt with. So, yeah, if your priority and your resources enables it, I think it would be worthwhile to consider an amendment to IFRS 1 to deal with the CTA issue submitted and restrict the amendment to recycled OCI.
I don't think it's just our resources as a sort of absolute amount. It's rather that when we did the agenda consultation, we were quite severe is the word that's coming to mind, but it's not the right word, but quite strict with how many projects we took on. So, yeah, I think some people might wonder whether it would be the best use of our time to do a bigger project relative to some of the other things we said we can't do just now, but I hear what you say, because I think the staff do have a reservation about the justifiability of just focusing on this component, although acknowledging the consequence of looking at a broader project. So that's one of the things I was thinking about. John?
I support finalising the agenda decision. I'm not in favour of a project to look at this. I think you would have to look two things. One, I think you'd have to look broader at other components of equity, and I think that's going to raise a whole lot of other issues, particularly for equity OCI that recycles hedge reserves and various different things. So I just think it's, I'm not sure that the benefit outweighs the cost. I also think it's a bit simplistic to say this is just that the subsidiaries' cumulative translation differences are just a component of the parents. IFRIC 16 is clear that your parent can actually have cumulative translation differences from direct consolidation of the subs without it aggregating up through subsidiaries. So I actually don't think, I mean, this idea that the subs, CTD, and the parents are the same sort of comes from, if they're different functional currencies, if the parent has consolidated directly all the subs, then there's a lot more complexity in assuming they're just the same cumulative translation difference. So I'm not really convinced that it's a project on this is going to be as simple as it seems by just adding this in as an exemption. So I'm not in favour of taking on a project on this.
Thank you. Bruce?
Thanks, Sue. I agreed with the agenda decision as written. I think we could go with it. Interestingly, I made a comment here when I read this. I think we could do it. If we really is enough need for it, I think we could do this as a very small amendment. I accept that there are bigger issues with equity, and I think we could open a can of worms. But on this specific issue, I think if we really felt this was just something we could resolve quickly, I think it can be done with no scope amendment. But I wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't prioritise it if there were limited limited projects to be taken.
Andrew?
I agree with the technical analysis in the paper and the way it feeds into the draft agenda decision. Having read through the comment letters, I wonder whether we might think about being a little more helpful, because IFRS in general doesn't deal particularly well with movements within equity. And in principle, I'm not sure why it would be unacceptable to conform the subsidiary and parent foreign exchange balances. I'm a little wary of expanding it beyond that. I would see it as something very narrow in scope for the reasons that others have mentioned, that you can get into all sorts of areas of, if you start tinkering with cash flow hedge reserves, then does that upset hedge accounting somewhere? If you deal with property, plant and equipment revaluations, well, does that give you a problem elsewhere that you've not really thought about? So if we were to do something, I think I would keep it very narrow in scope and only focus on cumulative translation differences. If I look at the basis for conclusions to IFRS 1 that deals with this issue, where we're looking at the exposure draft of IFRS 1, there was the question of why would you want to do something a particular way? And so there were the arguments that an entity might know aggregate cumulative translation differences, but not the amount for each sub, or the previous gap amount might not actually be something that reflected IFRS. If you conformed with the parent, then you would have something which would be conformed with IFRS numbers, and it would perhaps sidestep some of the concerns in BC 54 that respondents to the exposure draft raised. So I personally think that it would be a good idea for us to have a look at whether we could do a small and surgical amendment to IFRS 1 purely for CTDs, but not to go any further into equity.
And I think just to clarify, I only bring it up at the minute, not necessarily directly to your point, Andrew, but just to get other members of their mentioning to focus on that if possible, because I think when we were writing, as you can sort of see in paragraph 37, we were kind of feeling a bit torn. We're saying, look, if we were just to go in and surgically do currency translation difference, you know, we think that would be relatively straightforward. We're not, I think John's comments are useful, and if we were to do that, we'd at least need to look at IFRIC 16. But maybe that could be done quite narrowly. The whole point we thought, though, is if the board is going to go out and do that, then it needs to be able to justify why that and why not other components. To Bonnie's point, so if it is about practical relief, then people would say, well, why not other components? If it is about amounts flowing through P&L, they'd say, well, why not at least, you know, hedge accounting and something else? So I think maybe what I heard from you, Andrew, but tell me if I'm wrong, is you might justify it on the basis of kind of maybe spelling out a bit of the cost-benefit assessment if we think we can do this kind of narrowly and relatively straightforwardly. Almost if we were to go wider, there could be potential unintended consequences, etc.
Yeah,
is that right? Or I suppose it just would be really helpful and useful to know how, if the board were to do it for some components of equity and not all, how would that be justified in a sense?
Yeah, and just to answer the point, I think that is exactly it. That I think that we could get into a great deal of complexity if we try and cover all parts of equity, whereas if we narrowed it to this one area, then potentially we give some quite valuable relief to groups where subsidiaries are adopting IFRS in waves as you go down the group. And therefore, it gives a very workable solution, which I think the Japanese comment letters raised. But I would focus only in that, because once you get into the other reserves, there are all sorts of things that I begin to drift into that I find a bit uncomfortable, where we would, I think, end up tripping up and might have a project that would extend far further than we meant to.
I was surprised when I read the comment letters that we didn't get some more colour in terms of just how complex or otherwise it was to have this lack of relief in IFRS 1, because my recollection when the committee talked about it last time was that we'd sort of had that as a basic sort of assumption. I'm not sure if it's universal, but I thought the majority view was we thought that it wouldn't be terribly burdensome because it was a fairly static difference. But we didn't really get much feedback on that at all, other than a sort of general desire that relief is a good thing. We didn't really get any specifics in terms of how complex or otherwise it actually was. So.
Yeah, if I could maybe respond to that. So I was thinking perhaps you've got some like a multinational group which has thousands of subsidiaries, and therefore you have something where if subsidiaries are moving to IFRS at different times, then you have 100 going this year, 100 going next year, 150 the year after that, and you need to track all of the differences for each of those as you go along. And if you had some mechanism of conforming the balances, then all of that record keeping promptly falls away.
In that fact pattern, if it happened, yes, but does that happen very often, that you'd have all these different bits and pieces coming into IFRS at different times?
I think it's something which is relevant. You see groups of subsidiaries which adopt at different times depending on jurisdiction.
Yang Su?
Actually, when I read the staff paper, I was impressed by many insights from the comment letters. For example, you know, they said that IFRS 1 is not principle-based and already includes many exceptions. on maintaining two sets of CTD would not be the intention of the board, because it's going to be burdensome for the companies. So I was impressed by those kind of comments from the comment letters, but when I think of whether amendment is needed, my answer would be no. You know, for two reasons. The first one, you know, Andy explained a lot, but you know, benefits of amendment is going to be really benefit to us by spending lots of resources on it. And the second one I want to say is that, you know, if we have to amend some of the standard, then maybe we cannot restrict ourselves only to CTD. We have to think about all the components of the equity. Then it's going to be a lot more resources. So I just, you know, agree with the staff analysis not doing that to amend the standard.
Thank you. Bertrand?
Yeah, just to precise my previous comments, obviously I would lean towards Andrew's view, just amending IFRS 1 on CTTs. We can find a way to do so and to do a very surgical set amendment, that then it's fine. I expanded the fact mentioning recycled OCI, because it's something that is defined in IFRS and can be then, without expanding that to all components of equity or even to all components of OCI. So that was obviously to restrict the scope of work. Then if we can even restrict it to just the question ask or the submission ask, as Andrew said, which is just CTDs, then it's fine with me.
Tony?
Agree with the analysis in the staff paper and the agenda decision as it's drafted. I wonder if the potential impact is broader than some people might think. Having said that, only evidence I have is anecdotal. I think there are groups where, because of jurisdictions moving to IFRS for private companies, that there may well be groups that do move at different times. The other time that you come across this is sometimes in connection with a carve-out, for example. Mm-hmm. So where you have a business that is carved out and therefore adopts IFRS later, but I don't really have a sense of how broad it is. And I think if we were going to make a fix, we'd need to be confident that it was broad enough. And at the moment, I think it might be broader than you might first think, but I'm not sure how broad. The other thing, I think I agree with what the staff said, is I would want to understand why we were only going to do CTD, if we were only going to do CTD. So on balance, I don't object to where the staff's gone. I probably wouldn't object to at least thinking about whether we should do something, but I think we'd need to be satisfied it was broad enough and that there was some logic for addressing translation differences and not other categories of equity.
Thank you.
I agree with, for the agenda decision, I agree with the staff's analysis, technically correct, and agree to finalize it. I also would encourage looking at a project to amend one on whether it should be narrow or broader. My fear is if we went just a narrow approach and just on CTDs, we're going to get a whole bunch of comment letters, or we're going to get then IFRIC requests, submissions to expand it beyond that. Yeah. And so I guess why not explore, if we're going to add or if we're going to explore an amendment, probably best to explore it broader than just the narrow.
Thank you. Carl?
Thanks. I'm supportive as well of amendment instead of an agenda decision. And like Andrew, I would prefer a very, very narrow CTD amendment instead of a broader project.
Okay.
It will take a lot of resources, a lot of time, and the main issue at this moment is just this, and let's deal with only this issue.
Okay.
I agree with the finalizing the agenda decision. I think I struggled with the issue others have mentioned as to how important narrow scope amendment would be and how broad that narrow scope amendment is. And so I'm just wondering whether, rather than the staff, you know, us finalizing the agenda decision, staff doing a bunch of outreach to determine is it worth taking out a project, whether there's a happy middle ground, potentially by in our agenda decision saying that we considered, but didn't have sufficient evidence to conclude whether you know, a narrow scope amendment was warranted, which in and of itself might have invite more comment, because I think we're all struggling as to how big a deal is this. And I know in the Canadian context, I think as Tony mentioned, we have numerous instances where we do combined or carve-out statements where people apply IFRS 1, and you know, this hasn't been a major stumbling block for us, but perhaps it is elsewhere, as others have mentioned, as groups, large multinational groups, have subsidiaries adopting IFRS at different points of time.
Okay. I suppose the only to mention point, the only issue, I don't know if it is this worth the point of asking the question about finalising it. So if this were going out as tentative, then I think we more would be open to, you know, comments coming back on that. I suppose there's a question about whether we don't finalise it and make it tentative again.
My thought, and I don't know if this works, was to finalise it, but just in the when we talk about in the last paragraph, we could say we considered whether to do it, but there was insufficient evidence to conclude it was a pervasive problem.
Yeah.
Therefore.
So, and that would still invite people to tell
us. Out for comment per se, but it would, you know,
indirect.
People thought we still needed to think about it. Would know.
Yeah.
Martin.
Yeah, probably only one point, because I interpreted this sounding in a way that the local IFRS financial statements and the group financial statements, we will then see potentially the same values or same effects. Yes, to a certain extent that might be true, but on the other hand, one has to consider that specifically local financial statements and the group financial statements might differ by tying more and more new acquisitions to other issues. So I really have to say unfortunately, because I would like that from a group perspective, you can't use your local IFRS financial statements for group purposes without adjustments. And the adjustments, although now with IFRS 1 we will find some help here or so, will increase over time.
There will be differences, you're right. Okay, so I think we've got three options, so I'm going to tell you what I'm going to ask you so you can think about it, and then I'll call the vote. So I think our three alternatives are that first, whether we go with this committee goes with the staff's recommendation to finalise the agenda decision as set out in the appendix, or that we undertake some additional we explore something broader than just the CTD, but look at the potential to do an amendment to IFRS 1, which may or may not end up in a broader solution, or thirdly, that we just look at a narrow amendment to IFRS 1 that just deals with the CTD. So I think those would be the three alternatives. So,
and only to clarify that if we went with finalising the agenda decision, would we maybe ask then about Reinhardt's suggestion? I think that would be an add-on if we go there.
So do you want me to call the agenda decision as drafted or with Reinhardt's addition?
I'm happy either way. I just didn't know.
Mary? So just checking clarity, it's my understanding from what you said and from the paper is it's either agenda decision or
yes.
B or C. It's not agenda decision plus.
Although obviously if we finalise an agenda decision, it doesn't stop people telling us still that that wasn't what we've done, and encouraging us to have do something in addition later on. But I'm not asking the committee a combination of them. Yes, thanks for the clarification.
Well, I'm kind of curious as to why A is finalise and stop, not finalise and do outreach to explore.
I think.
Last committee meeting, I suggested a finalise and I got told I wasn't allowed to do that. We could do finalise plus, because that does have the benefit of at least giving certainty over what the words say today, and in addition, doing more. But then I'm going to have four options, so it's getting more and more difficult to call the vote because I...
But isn't that... that was my thought as well, because, I mean, I think that we're answering a question in the agenda decision, and I think that's clear, and I think we can give that guidance, whereas, I mean, I was going to ask the same question. I'd be quite in favour of the fourth one.
And maybe the way then, just to clarify, if that's an option where I hope it fits in the process is, if we do that, so if the committee were to go with, then finalising the agenda decision today is today saying the committee is not undertaking adding it to the standard setting project. If we then decide to do more work, then we'd say as there is more research work and research being done, and following bringing back that research, a decision then will be taken again then as to whether to actually do standards.
So that then means that if we've got committee, so do I need to call four things? Because I just wonder if there might be some committee members who think that enough is enough with just the agenda.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And no additional work.
If you don't mind freelance weighing in on that, I don't remember you being told you can't.
No, it's by you.
Okay. Then I'm going to repeat myself. I forget these things.
I don't.
The point I was just going to make is the commentary in the agenda decision is supplemental to what the basic function of the agenda decision is, which is to report a decision about whether you are or you are not going to add something to your agenda. And if you are going to ask for further research, it means you haven't yet decided what your agenda decision is. So to say we're going to decide, but then we're also going to do research, seems to be losing sight of the fundamental purpose of the agenda decision, which is to report your agenda decision.
I don't know whether to take this offline. The way I would justify it, even on the basis of our words, is that some of the clarifications we've made in our agenda decision we talk about adding it to the standard setting agenda. Now, this could be subtleties and you might say it doesn't work, but I would say then if we were to finalise the agenda decision, we are today saying the committee has not added a standard setting project. Potentially we'll do more research and the outcome of that research may be to then add a standard setting project, but still today it's not. But I don't know whether that's maybe too subtle between standard setting stroke research.
Okay, so this is what I will call. The first will be whose first preference would be to issue the agenda decision as is and to take the traditional approach of that meaning that there is no further standard setting work or research. The second alternative would be an agenda decision, but in addition saying that we will undertake some further research to look at whether an amendment to one would be considered. So that would be sort of saying this is what the words say today, but we'll look at whether we should make the world a better place. The third alternative would be not issuing an agenda decision now and undertaking research potentially with a broader scope. And the fourth alternative would be not issuing an agenda decision now and definitely just looking at the CTD as the potential amendment. Okay, so hopefully I'm going to remember my four now. So the first one is whose preference would be that we just finalise the agenda decision as drafted in this document. So it's just going to, we're just going to clarify what the requirements in IFRS 1 say as described in the agenda decision, and that will be the end of the topic. Who has that as their preference? Two. Sandy?
I have my hand up.
Okay, three. I might not get a majority on anything, of course. Which case I'll come back. Okay, the second one is that we have an agenda decision as drafted here, and then in addition we note that we will do some additional research to investigate modifications to IFRS 1.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
That's a majority.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get more than that on anything, so that will be what we'll do. Okay, that wasn't so bad. Does everybody think that was fair, just outcome and a fair way to call the votes? Because I was confusing myself along the way there at some points. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank
It'd be nice now if we're moving to an easier one, but my sense is it's not going to be. So now we're going to move to agenda paper 5D on IS 37 and the question of onerous contracts. Greg.
In June, the committee discussed a submission asking which costs are unavoidable costs in paragraph 68 of IS 37 when assessing whether a contract is onerous. The submission specifically discusses entities transitioning from IES 11 to IFRS 15, although the application of IES 37 applies more widely. The committee concluded that there are two ways to reasonably read the requirements in paragraph 68 of IES 37 on unavoidable costs of fulfilling the contract, and it published a tentative agenda decision outlining those two approaches. We received 11 comment letters. 10 respondents say a narrow scope standard setting project is needed to clarify the requirements in paragraph 68 of IS 37. 5 of those respondents say that the main reason to add a standard setting project is that the application of IFRS 15 will increase the population of contracts to which IS 37 applies. It is not clear to us as yet whether it is possible to undertake such a narrow scope standard setting project. And so we recommend finalising the agenda decision, subject to some clarifications. We also recommend asking the board to consider whether it should extract onerous contracts from the research pipeline project on IS 37 and add a narrow scope research project to this work plan. Before I ask question one, I note that we received an additional comment letter from Actio after the staff paper was published. Actio say that they agree with the committee's decision not to proceed with a very narrow scope amendment. However, they do have concerns about the scope of the tentative agenda decision. We discussed with Actio to understand their concerns better. They explained that finalising the agenda decision could cause disruption in practice for entities adopting IFRS 15 on the 1st of January 2018. They are aware of some entities applying different interpretations of unavoidable costs, and thus finalising the agenda decision, as proposed, could cause entities to make changes at short notice. They therefore suggest that standard setting activity should be undertaken. Question one is on page 5 of the paper. Does the committee agree with our recommendation to A, finalise the agenda decision, and B, ask the board whether it should add a narrow scope research project on onerous contracts to its work plan? If the board decides to do so, we recommend that the committee conducts this research on behalf of the board.
Bruce?
Thanks, Sue. I tell you what, I think there's a bit of a process issue that to me would be quite difficult to understand, and that is that when we come up with a tentative decision, we ask people for comment, and 10 out of the 11 people come back and saying we need to do standard setting. It's very difficult for us to ignore that. So to me, I think it's, I really think we get stuck between a rock and a hard place, because I think if we're going to turn around and say, well, thanks for the feedback, guys, 10 out of 11 of you said you need to do something, well, we're going to ignore that and go ahead and publish it anyhow. We're going to have to heavily justify how that's done. So, I mean, as much as we can get into the detail on it, my view would be that I don't think we can ignore the comments we've received from our constituents and say that we don't think there's a challenge. I think they've all come back very clearly. The message is that there is diversity. We can't leave that diversity, and they're all saying this needs to be addressed by some sort of standard setting activity. So I would think, in light of that, my view would be we would have to go through some sort of standard setting as opposed to an agenda decision.
Okay. And I don't disagree with that. I guess the only point I would make is that if the arguments raised in the 10 letters are compelling, then I would agree with that. If it's just we don't like the answer, then I'd sort of pop
it out. I agree with that, but I mean, yeah.
Okay. Reinhardt.
My comments are very similar to Bruce's. I would not be in favor of finalizing the agenda decision in view of the feedback received, and I do think that besides the existing diversity that exists, that diversity will be compounded on on implementation of IFRS 15, and so I think this will be a much bigger, broader issue, in which case I do think having a narrow scope or a project to address the issue of what costs are should be included in owner's contract costs is an important one, and so I would be in favor of doing that.
And I guess the way that I read the staff's paper, and I'm partly addressing this to the staff to make sure I understand, is that by coming up with this recommendation, which is slightly unusual because it's similar to what, you know, Mary and I were just debating on the last case where the staff is suggesting that we finalise an agenda decision that sort of says, yes, this is what the words say today, but in addition we realise that maybe it would be helpful to do more. You were trying, I guess, to acknowledge the feedback in the 10 letters by saying, well, we think the requirements today are clear, even though there's two alternatives. Mm. But in addition, yes, we see the point that it might be helpful to do more, so to sort of ride both horses at once. But I think, if I understand both Reinhardt and Bruce, yep. you've reached a different conclusion. As a result, you think it's better not to issue the agenda decision, but to do something straight away broader.
I think, in my view, the difference between the other two is I think this one is too big. The gap between the two is too big to just turn around and say. Whereas the other one was... We're interpreting IFRS 1. I mean, none of us disagreed that that's what IFRS 1 says right now, and we're happy with that answer under the current standard. Here we're saying that, and I think you're saying that the IFRS 15 coming up,
yeah.
it's so compelling to address that now, we don't think we'd be, yeah. I wouldn't be happy with an agenda.
I thought that's what you meant. I just wanted to sort of make sure I understood the staff's logic as well.
And just to let you know, hopefully it came across in the staff paper, we weren't at all, we agree with you and we agree with what the comment letter said to say, I think there's an identified problem here. Yeah. We're not doubting that at all. It's almost just at this stage the question mark we have is could we do something in onerous contracts, you know, in isolation of sort of, you know, wider work in IS 37, but at least that's where the research piece comes in. It's, you know, it's worth maybe exploring that and seeing can we, because there is an identified problem.
Because the challenge for the committee is that in some cases where we've wanted to do more and then it's turned out that we haven't been able to do it within the sort of reasonable scope and we've ended up leaving things unanswered. It's never ended with us getting a lot of praise for how helpful we've been in the interpretation process. So I guess the staff's slight hesitation, I guess, and why they were keen on the agenda decision plus is that there's some nervousness based on the initial assessment about how feasible it will be to have this sort of targeted issue in the context of IS 37 without doing the bigger IS 37 projects. And so, but I guess if we go, if the committee's decision is to go that path, we can always circle back and say, well, it seemed harder, so what's plan B? Young Sue?
Yeah, I just want to concur with Bruce and Reinhardt, but a little bit for different reason. You know, I think there's something that we do not know yet in the agenda decision, or there is something that we do not have any common understanding. My concern is about the definition of incremental costing that has been put into the agenda decision as an example. Let me just read it. It says that an entity would include depreciation of assets used to complete the contract if the entity has purchased the asset only to fulfill the contract. And I think this definition is not the same as the common definition of incremental costing. In incremental costing, our common understanding is the timing. So what I'm trying to say is that if the contract becomes onerous before the asset is purchased, this definition is right. But what if the contract becomes onerous after the asset has purchased? And the depreciation cost of the asset is not an incremental costing anymore. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, some of the definitions in the agenda decision might not be agreed by the other accounting people. So I mean, what I'm afraid is that if this definition is not acceptable by many people, then maybe there is something that we didn't think enough to issue the agenda decision. So I just concur with the Bruce and the Reinhardt that do not issue an agenda decision, but to do some research on this project.
Andrew?
I think Bertrand may have been first.
Bertrand?
No, I'll go.
You can. I mean,
very kind of you. Thank you. I'm one of those in the band who thinks that we should ask the board to do something. And thinking about this in the context of there being a wider project at the board which will come along at some point, I think I would be in favour of restricting this to contracts within the scope of IFRS 15. And part of the rationale for that would be to avoid upsetting existing practice for all the other contracts that are already accounted for under IS 37, but to deal with the issue which has come up on 15, where there seems quite clearly to be some additional help needed. So I agree with comment letters that say we should refer it to the board. If I look back at the board's discussion during the development of IFRS 15 to the discussions around 2011 and 12, it seems that there was at least a fairly strong majority view at the board that the cost should be more than the very, very narrow view of what incremental might be. So it does seem to be something that would be worth thinking about. The other thing that I did wonder a bit is the interaction between the impairment test in paragraph 69 and the requirements of 67 and 68 of IS 37, because 69 tells you to do an impairment test before you go back and do the onerous contract assessment. And that implies that when you do the onerous contract assessment, you've already done something that takes into account more than incremental costs because you've done your impairment test. So there may be some interaction in there. But I think at this stage, I would just restrict it to IFRS 15 in view of the wider project coming along.
Okay, thank you. Bertrand.
Actually, when we discussed first this issue, we decided for quite we decided for an agenda decision, a tentative agenda decision. It was not too broad, not too narrow, so quite in the middle. And then I totally appreciate and I thank you. I thank the staff for that. I think on this issue they have and we should have all a rather pragmatic approach. And effectively, hearing everybody today, having heard also Actio and having read the letter, I think their main concern is whatever might cause a change now, while people are concentrating on the transition to IFRS 15. But if we issue an agenda decision, effectively, even if it might conflict with some practices today, so even though I thank the staff for the pragmatic approach proposed, effectively, maybe it would be worthwhile not to issue an agenda by precaution, not to conflict with current practices, and effectively, what you proposed, i.e., to do a specific project on this specific issue, and not to to link that with a more global project on IS 37, it means that effectively, in a rather short time period of time, it might be feasible to do something specific on this. So within the boundaries probably of what we wrote within the various agenda decisions. So I think it would be fair. Yeah.
Martin?
I do not like the diversity. However, I believe with regard to IFRS 15, it is already too late. Consider if we now would come up with the agenda decision or so. Yes, theoretically there are 3 months' time to implement, but on the other hand, with regard to systems and overall, it's done, to be honest with that. Furthermore, I would like to see a broader solution which then really covers IRS 37 in total, what is meant by incremental cost. But for me, the way then would be to ask the board first, before we have an agenda decision, what would be in the appropriate direction, because without an alignment with the board, sooner or later we will fail, and I guess it needs really to be discussed on board level how to go on with that, and then with that reflection we might go for a decision.
Thank you. John?
I mean, I don't support finalising the agenda decision. I think we should be putting it on the agenda said at previous meetings, I think we could, I don't think we have to open up the whole issue of owners' contracts and economic benefits. I think we could usefully explore what are unavoidable costs. And we might come to the conclusion that it needs some standard-setting activity, but I'm not even convinced that we couldn't do it through an interpretation, and I think we should be taking it on the agenda. I think that the issue is too big to be left, and I think the diversity in the two, I mean, there's different views that there's more than two that are now being used, and some people believe that don't want to finalise the agenda decision because there's other methods we're precluding, which might, you know, which we, to be fair, we haven't explored all of the possible interpretations of unavoidable costs, but the two that are there are so different that I think we can't live with the diversity. So I would support putting it on the agenda and doing, us doing exploring whether we can do some more work and provide in, perhaps an interpretation.
Jennifer?
When I talked about this issue with others in my group, we also sort of questioned whether maybe more in process, is it appropriate to finalize the agenda decision at this point? And maybe it's different to have sort of, we're sort of looking at that, the added language around report to the board, the fact that there's still a question about whether or not the board should potentially take on a project, should there be an agenda decision finalized. I think another point is similar to what others have raised around, maybe in a way, perhaps creating more diversity by having these two views out here around unavoidable costs. Don't know. It's not something we see all that often in our own work, but just sort of that question as to, will this actually lead people in a different direction in terms of how they thought about unavoidable costs? And then I guess thirdly, as others have mentioned, this has become even more of an issue with the IS 11 type arrangements coming in now here, and maybe it's people hadn't really focused before on these words, or maybe they would more so now. And so, again, maybe all of that, we also had the feeling of, you know, obviously we prefer that there not be optionality or diversity if it can be narrowed. So maybe more work might be needed.
Sandy, did you have anything you want to say?
Sorry, couldn't get it off mute.
She was already talking.
I don't know. I guess I share others' views. I mean, I just don't know how quickly work on the cost could be done, you know, and if we're just going down another hole. But I don't know. I'm sort of undecided.
Okay. Thank you. Tony?
Yeah, I guess I'm probably much the same place as I was last time. I wasn't convinced last time that we wouldn't be able to resolve it efficiently. And so I'm probably in a very similar place to John. I think it's a large issue. It's set to get a bit bigger when IFRS 15 is adopted. And I know we can't fix it for when IFRS 15 becomes effective, but I would, rather than issue the agenda decision, I would prefer that we took something on and explored whether or not we can answer the question, perhaps through an interpretation of 37, at least explore whether we can do that. One thing I don't think we can do is restrict it to contracts that come into 37 via IFRS 15, because I think the board was clear that 37 ought to be applied to contracts with customers. I think that's what 15 says, and so I think if we're going to address it, we have to address it for all potentially onerous contracts.
Okay.
At the last meeting, I was not in favor of adding a broad project, but after seeing the comment letters, having some more discussions, and hearing the arguments here, I can understand the arguments for taking on standard setting and supporting it. On the part on the proposed agenda decision, I'd like to understand a little bit more what is being proposed. In my mind, the agenda decision that's proposed here has got two pieces to it. One piece says what the costs do not include, and that's the IFRS 11 and IFRS 15. So IFRS 11 going away, you can't use that. IFRS 15, you can't use the direct contract costs in that. And then it goes on to say what is possible, and it only has the two possibilities. I understand the point about wanting to get rid of that piece because it may not capture all of what's being used out there. I can accept that. I am a little bit curious, though, about the first piece. Are we getting rid of the piece that says you cannot apply IFRS 15 because don't we want to stop that practice before it starts?
Good question. Jimmy?
I'm fine with the finalizing the current agenda decision, even though some of us mentioned that this issue could be very big and broad and it's too big for us to take. But for now, no decision, it could be worse. I think the board, obviously the board knows the diversity in practice. Some of the board members are here. And we don't need to ask them if this issue is that big or important and the board may take it by themselves. So I think for now, for our purpose is to make our own job to make the agenda decision as we see it. And if the board would like us to do something, they will tell us. Otherwise, it's gonna stop this issue and wait for the big initiative that gonna take, maybe as you mentioned, forever. So I think we have some decision is better than no decision, and just keep the world wandering and doing whatever they have been doing. So I'm fine with the agenda decision.
Okay. Mary?
I just wanted to offer what are, I want to make clear, some personal thoughts about scope and the scope issue. A first observation is that our IS-37 project is a pipeline research project, and I think something being a pipeline, which means inactive, should not preclude the interpretation committee saying that work is, you know, that they should undertake work in an area that crosses over with something that is pipeline. Because if it's pipeline, it's far enough away from being finalized. That's just a generic thing. The second thing, I'd like to echo very much what Tony said about when I think about what IFRS 15 says, go apply IS 37 when it comes to onerous contracts. So I don't see how the interpretation committee could say we're going to develop guidance about how to apply IS 37 that would apply only if you were looking at IS 37 because you were sent there by 15. Now, there's a huge difference between saying we're only going to look at the onerous contracts piece or maybe even the cost piece of IS 37 because that's where we've become aware of the issue. You know, that's a narrow scope project. I would find it difficult to justify doing that only for IFRS 15 contracts and not for all contracts to which IS 37 is being applied in terms of are they onerous, and if they are onerous, you know, how do you determine the amount? And I'm not trying to say you should do it or you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying in terms of thinking about scoping, even if you focus on an IFRS 15 contract that's been sent to that, I think you cannot, as the example, I don't think you can limit your analysis to that fact pattern. I think there's also, I'm not sure who made it, a very good recommendation that maybe if the committee decides to try and scope a project that undertake some kind of standard setting or interpretive activity, I think it is a good idea to, after you've had your scope discussion, pause, have it reported to the board, and have get a sense of the board in terms of the scope of that project before investing a lot more in it. It's just we've all been around the it goes too far and then backtrack a lot. So I think checking along the way and earlier in this process would be a good project plan.
Andrew?
Just a related point, just to give a little bit of color to the suggestion that I'd made on restricted to 15, was that the original proposal on the development of IFRS 15 was for onerous contracts to be
dealt with within IFRS 15, with the comment letters then saying, well, you've got an owner's contract section in IS 37, why not do that? So it's partly with the view that the board was considering that separately at the time. It's also partly on the question of scoping and whether doing a broader project might end up being something that took a great deal of time. Personally, if we were able to do a wider one which dealt with all owners' contracts, that's great. So I wouldn't have the least problem with us looking at that. I think I'd probably, just picking up on Mary's last comment, perhaps want to reflect a little once a little bit more work had been done, just to see how big a project it was going to be, and therefore how long it was going to take.
Chung Wu?
Thank you. I agree with the Mary's point and Andrew's point. You know, the issue is maybe more related to the amendment of IT rather than ISO 37. The unavoidable cost concept has been for a long, long time in practice. All of a sudden, the IS 11 was there, but I-15 does not cover that. That was the issue. So if there you toss this issue to the board, then you are asking us, maybe reconsider the IFRS 15 requirements rather than IS 37. Because, you know, just Andrew pointed out, we discussed a lot on this issue, whether we IS 15 requires something on the on owner's contract or not. I guess we spent many, many meetings on this. The final conclusion was we toss everything to ISO 37. So I guess, you know, to me, actually, the interpretation committee's conclusion on two interpretations possible, it's strange to me. Because, you know, many people think this unavoidable cost may be some kind of concept, you know, for the past many, many years. But all of a sudden, you are suggesting two. So that's a kind of something, you know, maybe that I can understand easily. But however, that's another issue. But if you toss this issue that we cannot deal with in the amendment IS 37, that's also not the relevant standard. Also, that's in the research pipeline, so it'll take a long time. But as Andrew said, maybe we can consider IFRS 15 amendment. But it's not easy to think about the amendment to IFRS 15 is coming soon. So as Jan said, maybe now the interpretation committee must be the main part to consider this kind of a issue, maybe again or in future, near future.
Yeah, and I think what's important probably is just the point that maybe Mary and some others were making is this would be looking at IS 37. This is not looking at IFRS 15 because these requirements are in IS 37, even though it's IFRS 15 contracts end up, you know, being put through 37. So,
okay. So, given all of those comments, I think my takeaway. Tell me if you disagree. But my takeaway is that overall, it sounded like a majority of the committee is not in favour of finalising the agenda decision, but rather that we look at doing some additional work, trying to contain the scope, to look at what we can do to clarify this issue with a particular focus, I think, on costs, and to do some scope work on that and bring it back for the committee to look at. I think, particularly because of the timing of IFRS 15, I think that's a fair thing to do for people anyway. And I think just two observations, which I think echo what others have said, but just to emphasise, I do worry about us going down a rabbit hole that might be, you know, more difficult than what we had anticipated, and I don't think we'll do anyone any favours if they end up with no more clarity than where they are now. So I think we need to be disciplined in two ways. One is making sure that we are as careful as we can be with the scope of this, and that we do a sort of reality check on that scope as we go along, and that if we do get stuck, that we are brave enough to stop and reassess whether we're going down the right path or whether we need to reconsider an agenda decision at some point in time. But also, I think the other thing we need to make sure we do is to avoid any disconnect as much as we can between us and the board, and to make sure that we're sort of touching base with the staff that are maybe thinking more broadly about the IAS 37 project more holistically, and also the board, just to make sure that we're as lined up as we possibly can be along the way to avoid any problems down the track as well. So I think just two things to keep mind of, but we'll ask the staff to go away and think about how we could scope and work on coming up with something to do some standard setting work, research for some standard setting work for the, led by the committee, but with the blessing of the board rather than proceeding to an agenda decision.
Not to pull things up, only to say that we already heard and we've scribbled down any suggestions and thinking about our research work already mentioned. Is there anything else? Question three in the paper kind of touched on, do you have any other thoughts for us? Is there anything else that anybody hasn't mentioned so far that they wanted to?
And also not even directly on the scope of the research piece that the staff are going to work on, but I think Bob raised a good point in terms of the front piece of the agenda decision,
yeah,
and the fact that it is 37 you go to now rather than 15 or IS 11, and whether from a staff perspective we need to think about whether there's any need for additional education on that front just to help people understand that in the context of Plan 15.
So we'll think about whether there's any piece of material or something we could put on the website that might.
Okay. All right. So now, moving on to paper 5E, the role of watch discussion.
We'll now move on to agenda paper 5E, recommending the finalization of the agenda decision on goods acquired for promotional activities. In June 2017, the committee published a tentative agenda decision, noting that paragraph 69 of ES 38 applies to goods acquired solely for advertising or promotional activities. Paragraph 69 of ES 38 requires an entity to recognize such expenditure when incurred. The committee received six comment letters. Four respondents agreed with the committee's technical analysis and tentative conclusions. Two of these respondents suggested the committee make some clarification to the wording of the agenda decision. The respondents' concerns, together with our analysis, are discussed in paragraph 9 to 17 of the paper. Two respondents disagreed with the committee's conclusion. One respondent disagrees that an entity applies ES 38 to the goods. The respondent also says it is more appropriate to assess whether the goods have an alternative means by which the entity could generate value. Similarly, the other respondent says that an entity should recognize the cost of these goods as marketing expense only if and as far as the entity cannot use the good for another purpose. The respondents' concerns are outlined in paragraph 18 to 20 of our paper. Our analysis is shown in paragraph 21 to 31. I would like to highlight in particular paragraph 5 of ES 38, which is reproduced in paragraph 21 of our agenda paper. Paragraph 5 states that ES 38 applies to expenditure under advertising. On the basis of our analysis, we agree with the tentative conclusions reached by the committee at its June 2017 meeting. We think the committee doesn't need to make any substantive change to the tentative agenda decision in this respect. We therefore recommend finalizing the agenda decision subject to some wording clarification. The proposed wording for the final agenda decision is outlined in Appendix A of the agenda paper. Since finalizing the paper, we have had one suggestion on the agenda decision that I would like to mention. At the beginning of the second paragraph, we recommend adding a sentence that would read as follows. Paragraph 5 of ES 38 states that ES 38 applies to expenditure on advertising activities. Accordingly, the committee concluded that if an entity acquires good, etc., the wording of paragraph 2 would then continue unchanged. I will now ask whether you agree with our recommendation to finalize the agenda decision.
First, I appreciate you getting us so far ahead of schedule to create time, enough time.
I didn't want to feel constrained.
And I got to make one more push for this. Obviously, I disagree with the agenda decision. So I think that before you get to paragraph 69, you've got to be in the scope of 38. And so I don't think you're in the scope of 38. When the board amended 38, we didn't change the title. It's still the title's still intangible assets. Didn't change paragraph 2. Paragraph 2 says this standard only applies to intangible assets. Paragraph 4 helps me to understand what intangible assets are, and it says, look, it still might be an intangible asset if it's got a physical aspect to it, but that's only if the physical aspect is secondary. Now, staff in the paper then refers to paragraph 5, which says, well, advertising in the scope of this. But if you look at the last sentence of paragraph 5, it talks about a situation where you've got an activity where, again, the physical element is secondary. So it is relaying, it's emphasizing again the requirements in paragraph 4. So in the case that we've been dealing with the, we affectionately refer to the Rolex watch, but the watches, the air conditioners, the refrigerators, I just don't see how it meets the condition in paragraph 4 for that physical element to be secondary. I don't think giving a gift with something of that substantial value is the same as an advertising activity.
Okay. Carl?
Yes, I'm comfortable with finalizing this agenda decision. I think it's a very straightforward analysis, and I agree with staff's conclusion.
Thank you. Martin?
I do not agree with the agenda decision. I mean, last time I already explained a little bit the gold bar story, or you could also consider other things as acquiring 5,000 liters of diesel with the intention to give it to your customers. However, you have no further external commitment, and the asset has an alternative use. So if management, for whatever reasons ever, decide then at a later point in time not to do that marketing campaign, you still have the full value out of that asset, so to say. So therefore, for me, the question is how you read the basis of a conclusion 46B, whether it is a rebuttable presumption if you are acquiring something for marketing purposes. In general, you have to expense it, or if there might be other exceptions, as explained, where really the alternative use and the alternative value is the predominant one, when I expense that, if I use that really then for marketing purposes, so give it away. And this is for me something where we need to find a distinction, and therefore I really have the challenge not to come to that conclusion.
Can I just challenge, or maybe Tony, are you going to respond to anything Martin says, or anybody
else?
Because otherwise, I was going to respond, but I would leave other members to it.
On the scope point, anybody going to respond, or is
Katrina going to? I was going to say that I thought Martin's concern had been addressed by the inclusion of the word solely.
Yes, and that was my point.
So my sense of the point that you make is if a company acquires an asset that could be used for something else, and maybe the intention is for it to be used for something else, then maybe you would end up recognizing it as an asset. And I thought that the staff in making the amendments to the agenda decision had addressed it by saying that if you buy something and your intention is to give it away, and that's the intention when you buy it, then my sense is it gets caught by 46B and paragraph 5 in the scope. But if you buy something use undetermined or buy something for another purpose, then maybe you get to a different answer.
I highly appreciate also the adding of that word, and I saw that. But as I mentioned, what I miss then is really the commitment to do so. One is the management intention. It's the same in other standards. in most of the things we make a differentiation between intention and commitment. And I've no external promise or so whatever to do so. And if I acquire a commodity, I can decide sooner, or I can revise my decisions. And also with that, more or less, in a very good year, I could decide to, well, acquire some stuff which alternative use, arguing it is for marketing purposes, and then in the next year, more or less, selling it to the market without using it for marketing purposes. So,
Martin, I don't disagree with your sort of logic and what we might like the standard to say, but if I pull you back to what words we've got to hang our hats on to interpret, are there words in the front of the standard that help with your argument or support your argument?
I think I have some response to Martin's comment. I agree with the staff's analysis. And back to Martin's worry or concern, internally, the management intention or decision is something that is traceable. And the accountants should look at their internal memos or something to do the journal entries accordingly. Like IFRS 9, the management intention all over the place. We don't need to the third party or the auditors to double check. It's the internal accountant's job to do the journal entries or accounting treatments accordingly. If, as Martin said, the management changed their way of thinking, that's the credibility of that company. Of course, if they really do that, they have the right accounting treatment to reclaim those the value of them and put them on the books as assets or as something else, not fully expensed as promotional goods. But they could do that. I think it's legit. But if they do that often, the disclosure should show the credibility of their decision. That's it. It's not accounting's job to prevent them from reclaiming or changing their purpose. We just need to book their decisions accordingly. And if they change, they change. We just need to do the newly issued intentions and make them public. That's it. It's not an issue to stop this, the first place accounting procedure or treatment, just to write them off. And if they change, up to them. But if they change so very often, the market will show and will treat the company's credibility accordingly. So this is my interpretation on this.
Do you want to respond? And then I better let the other people in.
No, for me, the only question is, where's the difference between something which is easily to liquid in cash and an advance payment? Because if I acquire something which is more or less same liquid as cash, in extreme case, where's the difference to an advance payment? An advance payment, I would not recognize an expense for marketing purposes, whereas if I receive control out of that, say, commodity or so, I would expense it. That's my point.
John?
I agree with staff analysis. I think it's the correct interpretation of what's in IAS 38. I do have some sympathy for Bob. I wouldn't naturally go looking to IAS 38 for how to account for fridges. Is not sort of my...
You also have no concern.
Not the first standard I would look to, but I do think it's... I do think it's in scope, and I think it's quite clear. It is interesting, when the 2008 amendment was made, there was a lot of discussion about alternative use, and part of what drove the amendment was that, you know, about the catalogues and stuff, was that there's no alternative use. But of course, some of these goods do have an alternative use. But the wording, I think putting in the word solely brings in that what we're saying is there's no intention to use it for any other use. So the real question is it intention, or is it whether the functionality of the goods has another use? I mean, obviously catalogues don't have any other functionality except to send them out as advertising, but something like a fridge or watch has other functionality. But I think that the focus on intention is actually, I mean, that's what the words seem to say, so I'm comfortable to finalise the agenda decision.
Bruce?
Thanks. I mean, I was going to draw on a similar comment, I mean, and just in response to the conversation earlier. I mean, to me, intention is probably one of the most key things. And I, you know, when I look at paragraph 4, I mean, even Deloitte made comment to that. I mean, we talk a lot there about judgment. You need to make that judgment up front. And I agree with that completely. And I think paragraph 4 embodies that. It says, is it more significant, the physical factor or what you've got? So if we were looking at that, just by the way, on the paragraph 4 thing, to me, that there's judgment there. When you get to paragraph 5, I think then in my mind, it's scoped you straight in. And I think that it does come down to what your intention is up front. And I think that when we're having the discussion earlier, there are so many places in IFRS where we have change in intention, it tells us what to do, and change in intention tells us what to do. And I think that that's fine. To me, this is a day one issue. This isn't a what am I going to do in 3 months? Well, actually, instead of giving the fridge away, I'm going to use it. We're not trying to debate that. We're debating on initial recognition, does it fall within the scope of IS 38? And to me, I, as I said, when we had this discussion earlier, I have sympathy for where it is, but the way I read the words, I just don't get to a different answer.
Reinhard?
My views are consistent with what others have said. I think to the extent management has acquired the items solely for advertising purposes, it's in my I agree with the staff analysis that it's in the scope of IS 38 and with the accounting. I think from an audit perspective, it may be difficult to establish the management intent, whether it's solely for advertising or not. Well, that's maybe an audit question. But having said that, if it's clear that that's what management's intent is, I agree.
Okay, thank you. Want to respond?
I just want to come back on just one point, and I understand the point about the purpose and how you read the literature, but in IS 38, basis for conclusion, paragraph 5, it says, the board concluded that the purpose for which an entity holds an item is not relevant to its classification as an intangible asset. So that seems to contradict.
I don't know, but I mean, in the context of this, first of all, I suppose the only in the agenda decision, at least putting the words together, we tried to stick quite well, absolutely, by the way, not introducing any new words that weren't already sort of in the standard or in the basis. And so that word, the words you see in the third paragraph of the agenda decision that talk about have no other purpose come directly from BC 46B. And I can only think in that the paragraph that you quote about that is when I think about, you know, your point about IS 38 and it being titled intangible assets, and that when the board made the amendments they didn't change that, is at least when I read BC 46B that kind of supports the amendments, the intangible that the board had in mind in the context of expenditure on advertising or promotion is the customer's brand or its customer relationships. So when it's thinking about this, it's not thinking about the watch, it's thinking the intangible is the brand or the customer relationships. But I don't know if that's relevant to your point.
I understand your point. I just was trying to point out that for the basis of people basing it on the purpose of this, it's...
How would you consider BC5 in this specific instance then? How would you consider the effect of BC5 on the current analysis on this specific issue?
Well, the way I consider BC5 is saying it's not the purpose for which you're holding it. Look back to what is the characteristic of that asset, and then it goes back to, well, okay, if it's got, because then the scope says, well, intangibles are those that lack physical. Mm-hmm. These do have physical characteristics. And then it says, well, if it has a physical characteristic, then look to see whether the physical characteristic is secondary or primary. It never gets into then, what is the intention? What is your intention for the use of that asset?
How different is that to a catalog?
In a catalog, the physical aspect, the piece, the paper, the putting the papers together has very little value. All the value is in what's on those pages.
But that's an incredibly difficult link to make. I mean, if I decide to give you a Rolex watch, I must genuinely believe that the branding and things I'm giving you far exceeds the value of the watch that I'm giving you. I mean, that's the commercial rationale for doing it. So
if I gave you a 30 pages bound together, all blank, that has relatively little value. If I give you the 30 pages with all my products on that, that has a lot more value. If I give you a Rolex watch, whether it's got my brand or not on the back, some would actually argue that putting my brand on the back actually
declines, decreases the value. But, you know, that doesn't increase the value of that watch.
Well, I think, so I'm jumping in, but I think we've got to be very careful because we're all jumping to the emotive Rolex watch very quickly. Because, I mean, we all can say, well, hang on, there's a value in that. But, I mean, if I take a simple pen, I mean, if people go brand this pen, okay, would you say if I'm giving these pens out, it's marketing or it's physical activity? No, there's absolutely, there's the physical, this and that. But to me, it's all got to be the commercial substance behind anything you decide to do for marketing has to be that if I'm giving you something, I must believe that what I'm going to, we as an entity will give back, has got to far exceed the value of it. I mean, to me, that's how I've always seen things like marketing. I'm never going to give you a Rolex if I think the most I can get is $100 worth of work out of you. It just there's no commercial rationale between that. So if I'm believing that in doing something and branding it and giving it to you is going to result in more value for me, to me, that is the primary reason I'm doing it. Just because there's an alternative use and yes, it's a nice Rolex watch, to me, is not the issue. I mean, to me, the issue is what it's exactly what you're saying. What is the value within it? And the value to me, I think maybe it's just the way I'm looking at it. We have to work on the premise that the value of doing a marketing expenditure has to exceed the value of the actual physical asset. Otherwise, I wouldn't see why people would do it.
But then, Bruce, you're getting into the purpose, which then that's what BC5 I brought up for, because it says it.
That's my argument about the catalog. You can't get to a stage where we're saying, until you consider the purpose, you could give me a 30-page bound book. It's a physical asset. It's a book, and I can take it and give it away. It's an I-16 piece of paper. The moment I start getting to the stage of saying, well, hang on, there's something else within it, what you're saying is that you're saying the intangible value is more than the physical paper that's there. I'd argue that with anything in marketing, that the intangible value attached to whatever the physical is has got to end up being more. I know we're starting to re-debate it, so we're having a good time.
I think you probably gathered from what I said previously, but I didn't say that I agree with staff's conclusions, and I agree with the agenda decision as amended. I think these things are in the scope, and I think the standard tells you what to do with them.
Andrew.
I'll start by saying that I agree with what's in the paper and I agree with the analysis in the agenda decision, but perhaps I could just do a little step by step through to support that a little bit. I think in terms of the scope of IS 38, I think that these things are brought in by paragraph 5. And to the point in paragraph BC5, I think I may read it slightly differently, because BC5 talks about the essential characteristics of intangibles, and then says the purpose for which you hold an entity with those characteristics isn't relevant to its classification. So I'm not sure that's quite on point. If I look at the agenda decision, I paused a little when I looked at the addition of the word solely and wasn't initially quite sure, but I think, having reflected a bit, it fits quite neatly with the first sentence of paragraph 69, where it says, in some cases, expenditure is incurred to provide future economic benefits, but no intangible is actually recognized. So that quite clearly says to me that you need to be identifying that expenditure. And that then is important when I think a little bit more broadly, because while the agenda decision is right in what it says about advertising and promotional activities, this actually applies to a much wider range of expenditure, because it will apply to all of the items in paragraph 69, and it's also going to apply to anything that you acquire for research purposes, because research activities are expensed. Therefore, if you acquire an asset to undertake research activities, you're instructed to write off immediately. That's my reading of it, unless you're going to be inconsistent. And that brings in the clear need, and why solely is a very useful word to be in there. Because if I look, for example, in the pharma industry, you may have materials that are purchased which are used both for research purposes and the identical materials used in production. And so you buy, let's say, 1,000 kilograms of something, 100 you'll use for research, the rest is going into production. So you need to be very sure about what you're using for what. Otherwise, you can have all the playtime that Martin was talking about earlier on. So the one thing that I would like to be considered
is whether the agenda decision also contains a note that this goes beyond advertising and promotional activities, so that it picks up that it's on other items in IS 38 which would be expensed immediately, because otherwise we might find that the subtlety of it would get missed.
Yang-Sun?
I just want to say that I agree with the staff analysis conclusion. We are talking about day one issue. So intention is the most important thing that we have to think. Intention might be changed in the future, but initial intention, day one intention, is what we are thinking. So inserting the word solely is a very wise choice. I really like that idea. And as for the Rolex watch, I'm sorry, Bob, but you know, the Rolex watch might be very expensive, but as Bruce said, when a company gives a Rolex watch to somebody else, the company expects much greater intangible benefits out of it. So comparing the cost and the benefits, I think benefits is a lot better, I mean, a lot greater. So that's all. Sorry for that.
John, you've got to change your mind.
I agree with the staff analysis and with the agenda decision as worded.
Thank you. Martin?
Sorry, I only have potential practical. My last comment. from a practical perspective, if we say, okay, we are acquiring something solely with the intention for marketing purposes, and therefore we expense it. What is, would we say, okay, we decide on a marketing campaign, but not with regard to goods we are acquiring, but we have already on stock. So is the decision per se more or less free distribution of own stock material or inventories, that point in time to recognize that as an expense?
Are you going to submit that to the IFRIC?
The only point I want to make clear is always the question of how important alternative use might be in that consideration.
But I think that if, for instance, there's a vehicle that might be in an inventory that is used for R&D, at the point that it's used for the R&D would be the point at which it's expensed to R&D.
Absolutely correct. At the point you start to use.
Right,
but
right.
We but said, okay, with the decision, yeah, if, more or less. The
yeah, but if you're, when you're purchasing something for the purposes only of promotional activities, then that's the point at which you would expense. To me, that's consistent.
Yeah. I said I have it in general, so it's my own production. I only give it away for free, but anyway.
Okay, let's try and answer the question we got. So the question's on page 8. So does the committee agree with the staff's recommendation to finalise the agenda decision that's set out in Appendix A? Show of hands, please.
My hand is up.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. All right, I think we've earned a break. So we'll break for 15 minutes till 3:05. Thank you. Okay. All right, on to the last paper, 5F. Fashion Week? Yes, okay. Yep.
So let's move to agenda paper 5F. At its June meeting, the committee discussed a request to clarify how to account for the acquisition of an interest in an associate or joint venture from an entity under common control. In particular, the submitter asked whether it is appropriate to apply by analogy the scope exception for business combinations under common control in paragraph 2C of IFRS 3. The committee concluded that the entity does not apply by analogy the scope exemption for BCUCC in IFRS 3 and tentatively decided not to add this issue to its standard setting agenda. The committee also observed that in accounting for the acquisition of the interest, the entity would assess whether the transaction includes a transaction with owners in their capacity as owners. If so, the entity determines the cost of the investment, taking into account that transaction with owners. We received 11 comment letters on this tentative agenda decision. They are reproduced in Appendix C. 5 respondents agree with the committee's technical conclusion, 4 of which agreed to finalize the agenda decision. 1 respondent recommends that the committee does not finalize the agenda decision until the board completes its work on the BCUCC project. 5 respondents disagree with the conclusion and say the committee should not finalize the agenda decision. 1 respondent, ASBJ, expressed mixed views. In addition, 6 respondents suggest the committee remove the reference to transactions with owners in their capacity as owners from the agenda decision. The concerns raised by respondents, together with our analysis of these concerns, are presented in paragraphs 11 to 33 of the staff paper. On the basis of our analysis, we recommend finalizing the agenda decision subject to the changes mentioned in paragraph 33 of the staff paper. And I would like to now ask if you agree with our recommendation to not to add this issue to the standard setting agenda, and if yes, whether you agree with the amended wording for the agenda decision outlined in Appendix A.
Thank you. Okay. Reinhardt.
I'll be consistent with my comments the last time we discussed this issue. I personally do not agree with finalizing this agenda decision, and I've got a number of reasons for that. As we talked about at our last committee meeting, and I think as some of the commentators pointed out, when IFRIC last discussed this issue back in 2013, the committee acknowledged a lack of clarity around what is meant by paragraph 26 of IS 28 as to, and that's led to some diversity in practice, that rather than applying IFRS 3 paragraph 2C by analogy, that people have seen those words in paragraph 26 where it talks about the concepts underlying the procedures with respect to the acquisition of a subsidiary, that that's really importing the concepts in IFRS 3 into IS 28. And so the IFRIC acknowledged that some read the paragraphs in that way. And as I say, I do believe, having done some limited outreach in my jurisdiction in Canada, talking to the other large networks, this is a fairly common transaction and commonly has been treated in a manner different than the agenda decision, where particularly where you have a transfer of an investment in an associate under common control, either directly to another commonly controlled entity or indirectly where that associate is an investment within a subsidiary transferred to another subsidiary in exchange for shares, that those transactions have typically been done on a predecessor cost basis. So finalizing an agenda decision along these lines would be without transition provisions would be cause some upheaval in practice. And so, as I say, I personally do not think that the paragraph 26 of IS 28 is as clear as the staff would make it out to be in terms of I think there is an opposite view that rather than applying IFRS 3 paragraph 2C by analogy, it's just saying those concepts from IFRS 3 into IS 28. I think as well, consistent with the comments made by commentators in terms of the language around considering whether the transaction includes a transaction with owners and their capacity as owners, will create concerns, because I think there's nothing particularly unusual about this class of common control transaction as related to other classes of a common control transactions, and therefore, as commentators have pointed out, it can be interpreted much more broadly. And so for those various reasons, my own view is not to finalize this agenda decision. And although I know it is currently not part of either the business combination under Common Control Project or the equity method project, I think it's something that could very and should be part of that one of those projects.
Bertrand?
Yeah, I will also reiterate my previous comments when we first discussed that. I mean, it will lead to a quite an odd practical result. It would mean that for a subsidiary on which you have control, if you acquire such a subsidiary on a BC-UCC transaction, you would be eligible to an option not to perform a purchase price allocation, whereby for a similar transaction applying IAS 28, you would be forced to do a purchase price allocation. It means that for an entity where you have less capacity because you have not control over the entity of getting information, you will be forced to do more than for a subsidiary. It's a very practically it's an odd result. I think we could perfectly decide to amend IAS 28, and it doesn't change the core purpose of IAS 28. It's just a scope amendment, let's say, for very specific transaction, and that could then better align the practice with the option that is currently within IFRS 3.
John?
I support finalizing the agenda decision. I do think, when you read the standards, I think that IAS 28 applies, and I don't really think that I struggle to say how you can apply an exception from a standard by analogy to override a standard that actually directly applies to the transaction. And we already decided common control transactions are not outside the scope of IFRS standards, so I don't know how we would conclude otherwise here. I do think there is one situation, though. I mean, if a lot of group restructurings involve common control business combinations where there might also be associates being transferred. And I must admit, I would have thought that if an associate is being transferred as part of a common control business combination, then the exemption IFRS 3 would apply rather than the acquisition of associate, because it's actually part of a business. But I don't know that that's clear in the agenda decision. And maybe, maybe it's something we if we think that the associate will be accounted for separately from the business combination under common control, if it's actually part of a larger restructuring, then maybe we need to debate that and clarify in the agenda decision. But I would have assumed that if it was a larger business combination, then the business combination under common control exemption would apply and not IAS 28 to the acquisition of the associate. And we were only talking about asset acquisitions in terms of a common control acquisition of an investment in an associate. But other than that, I'm in favour of finalising the agenda decision.
Tony?
Yeah, I guess similar to some of the others, I'm saying much the same as I said last time. I agree with the staff's analysis and conclusion. I'm comfortable with finalising the agenda decision. I would prefer that we deleted all reference to the transaction, considering whether the transaction includes transaction with the owners in their capacity as owners, because I think that applies to a wide range of transactions that are under common control rather than specifically to this one. And so I would delete the remaining sentence, but otherwise I'm comfortable with finalising the agenda decision.
Okay, thank you.
I also support finalising the agenda decision. I think one, it's consistent with the conclusions that we reached in agenda paper 4, so I'd be troubled by reaching a different conclusion than we were there. And then as reference to, was referenced in the paper regarding some belief, paragraph 26, in the case that they're at, my reading of paragraph 26 is that it's for the measurement of the investment, not the scope of 28, and it says to use the procedures in consolidations of subs, not the scope of three.
I find myself very much in agreement with Reinhard that when I go back and read IS 28, then I can very easily read paragraph 26 as saying I should apply the same approach for a common control transaction involving the movement of an associate as I should for a subsidiary. And I don't think that it's a narrow part of measurement. The paragraph talks about the accounting for the associate. And that's a slightly wider range. So I can understand how you might read it one way or read it another way. But since I can read it a number of different ways, I don't think we can preclude one of those readings. The other part of it is that I do worry a bit about the way in which this would force rather complex accounting for associates where we don't have control and probably don't have that much access to the detailed information, where we have an exemption for subsidiaries. And it seems from a practical perspective to be slightly odd to say we're going to force you to do a purchase price allocation for any transaction involving an associate, even if you're moving ownership from one group subsidiary to another group subsidiary, so that receiving company must do a PPA, when if we'd done that with a subsidiary where we control it and have all the access, we don't need to. And that's why when I feel quite comfortable about reading paragraph 26 to say apply the same accounting approach as you do for a subsidiary and reading it in that way, I don't think I'm applying anything by analogy. I think I'm applying a reading that is perfectly valid from IS 28. I understand there are differing views, but I'm not really sure that it's is a particularly practical thing that we're asking people to do, nor do I think it's one which is intuitive in the context of the exemption given elsewhere, where it's actually easier to get the information to do the accounting.
Maybe just a couple of observations, and I always hesitate to make the observations as a chair, but on the other hand, I want to sort of be candid as well, and I'm sure I'm not going to make myself any popular with some people with what I'm about to say, but I think that for people that are sort of suggesting we shouldn't finalise the agenda decision and sort of alluding to a preference of making an amendment to 28, which I think, and maybe I'm over reading what some people are saying, but I think then the preference would be not just to sort of clarify what the staff and what I think our draft agenda decision said, which was that there is no exception for common control transactions. I think you're suggesting that we would go in and make an amendment to 28 that not just clarified, actually 26, paragraph 26 means you can't, it's just the pure procedures along the lines that Bob was saying, as opposed to the same scope as IFRS 3. I'm not sure how much appetite the board would have for making that amendment, in the sense that I think it's quite a big deal in the context of the BCUCC project. It's a different scope to what we've been talking about, and I'd be concerned firstly about timing, because I don't think the reason why this has come back is because we went back and looked at stuff that we'd parked previously because of research projects and said, let's look afresh at what could be actually dealt with now to give timely responses. And I think there's a risk that if we say don't issue an agenda decision, we're sort of reversing that decision and going back to saying, in effect, wait for the research project. And I think there will be a risk that if we were to take it to the board, that in the same way that the sort of response or the consequence of the clarification between 28 and 9 was not a fundamental reconsideration of the interaction but confirmation of the current interaction, that might be where we would end up. So I'm just wondering if people's objective is, or what the preference is to ask the board to look at amending paragraph IS 28 to scope out
BCUCC type transactions in here in the same way as an IFRS 3. I'm not sure how quickly that would or could be done, nor how much appetite there would be to do it more quickly. So I guess I'm just a voice of caution for what the consequences of not issuing an agenda decision might be. And also, I guess the other thing, and then I'll let you come in, yeah. Reinhardt, is I think we need to be careful to focus on, and I think the comments on what the words in 26 say are fair comment, but I think then we've got then a tendency to drift to whether or not we like the answer as opposed to what the interpretation of the current words is, and I'd like to try and separate those two if I could.
Yeah, and I can't speak for others, but for myself, what I'm not suggesting that we take to the board making a narrow scope amendment to paragraph 26. What I'm suggesting is that, consistent with when the last IFRIC discussion occurred, that there's a lack of clarity as to the applicability of paragraph 26, that issue be part of the BCUCC project or the equity method project. Mm-hmm. So as I say, I wouldn't suggest an interim step of just taking that specific issue to the ISB at this point, because I see no reason why we need to address that more urgently than those other issues that are tied up with the BC's UCC project, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's fair, but then also in response to that, which I think is helpful, if that is what you're thinking, we got a very strong message both in our agenda consultation and in response to the trustees' review of structure and effectiveness, that there's a perception that we're not dealing with things promptly enough in the Interpretations Committee, and that we've got a tendency to say, not now, let's wait for a research project. And I think we've got quite a clear message from our stakeholders that they prefer us to try and give clarity on current words where we can, as opposed to telling ourselves all the time, well, there's a research project, so let's wait for that. So I think we just have to be mindful of that as well.
If I could just make one rebuttal to that. The only reason we're addressing this now is because, to the point you made earlier, the IFRIC did not reach a decision, and so we're now reconsidering because there's greater clarity as to the scope of BCUCC and equity method project as it currently stands. It's not an issue that people have said to us is an urgent issue in practice. It's not that we've been requested to deal with this issue at this point in time.
Saved by the bell?
Maybe if I'll just interject and clarify, I think, and then I suppose that from our perspective as staff and writing the paper and some others, we think there's enough in the words that are there today to reach a firm conclusion on how, you know, that there's one way to read those words. And I think what you're saying, Reinhardt, is when you read the words, you don't think there is.
Two ways to read it.
Evacuate? Don't evacuate.
I asked a little trying to
go. If I could just clarify. If I could just. Just to clarify one point, I appreciate that there were some comments I made which talked about practicality, but when I talk about what I think 26 says, I think it is a technical reading of 26 that it does not preclude looking across and saying that you adopt the same approach as IFRS 3. So it's not just what I might or might not like it to say, I think it's what it does say.
And I realise that, which is why I thought one of the things you might have been suggesting would be that at minimum we would need to clarify what paragraph 26 would say.
I think that we could clarify that 26 doesn't preclude you doing it. And that would leave most people, I think, very much in the same kind of position as they're already in. I think that if we finalise the agenda decision as drafted, we would potentially be forcing a very large change in a very wide range of different entities. And my own view is that that would be inappropriate, because I think 26 can quite reasonably be read to include associates as well as subsidiaries under common control.
Bonnie?
So a lot of the comments that I was going to make have already been maybe more clearly articulated than what I was going to, but I have the same view as Andrew, Reinhardt, Bertrand, And I don't agree with the conclusion that it is clear as written. And I think that you can, as Andrew pointed out, you can get to the conclusion that to read paragraph 26 in a different way.
Okay. All right. Let me say just one thing. I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. The one reason is what Bob just said. Paragraph 26 is about the procedure. The second one I want to say is that associate is different from the subsidiary. Subsidiary is under the control. The associate is not under the control. They have a significant source. I mean, the influence with the other entity. So even if associate is within under the common control, no entity has a control of the associate at all. So I don't think IFR 3 should be applied to the associate. Instead, IAS 28 is a proper standard that should be applied to the associate.
Thank you. Julia.
Thank you, Sue. I'm actually slightly hesitating whether to make this comment or not, but I'm hoping that it might help a little bit to address Andrew's concerns and Reinhardt's concerns. And that's a slightly different angle of the discussion, and it's similar to the point that John has made. If we talk about acquisition of an associate under common control, there are actually two types of transactions that we can have at hand. It can be a direct acquisition, or it can be acquisition as part of a group restructuring. And if it is acquisition as part of a group restructuring, which is part of a larger transaction which meets the description of business combination under common control, such an acquisition would actually be captured by the scope of research project and business combinations under common control. And we might, well, the board might conclude that the predecessor method of accounting is appropriate, or the board might conclude that the acquisition method of accounting is appropriate. But my main point is that if it is an indirect acquisition, which is part of a business combination under common control, then from the point of view of that transaction, an associate is just one of the not identifiable assets of the acquired subsidiary. So that's a slightly different story. And I think this story is very different from a situation where it's a direct acquisition of an associate, where what you acquire is just an asset, which is similar to acquiring an item of PP&E, for example, under common control. So I think the helpful element, which I tried to bring into that some of acquisitions of associates under common control would actually be captured by the scope of the research project as long as they're part of a larger transaction.
But that leads to the comment made by some commentators as to the anomalous results. If it's acquired indirectly, i.e. you have a wholly owned sub A, owns an investment associate, transfers it to sister company B, that's under common control. As you said, that would be considered to be a business combination under common control. But if you had that same investment held in just directly and transferred it to sub B, then this would say you can't. It's not under business combination under common control, and therefore you have to measure it differently.
But is that really an anomaly? Like in one case, you're talking about business combinations under common control, and as part of that, you might have acquired an associate. In another case, you're talking just about acquisition of associate. Also, that said, it's not necessarily that those two transactions will end up with different accounting treatment, because we don't know yet what the board will conclude on business combinations under common control. It might conclude that you use the predecessor method, or it might conclude that you use the acquisition method, or it might conclude that you use a combination of the two depending on facts and circumstances. And we have committed in the scope paper, which we brought to the board a couple of years ago, then when looking at the accounting, we will consider implication and interaction with other transactions. So we will be having that in mind, if it helps.
Well, that argues for why waiting, as opposed to issuing an agenda decision now.
Can I ask a question? I'm sorry if this is inappropriate. But by the way, just to introduce Yulia for anybody who's not here. Yulia, by the way, it leads our BC UCC project at staff level, so it's fantastic, and that's why we asked Yulia to come along. So thank you, Yulia. And I should have rehearsed this question that I'm going to ask you, Yulia, but I'll ask you and John, and hopefully it's okay. It's just based on the comment that John made and then you made. Would you say then that in the context of if if within what is a BCUCC, a business combination under common control, there happens to be, you know, an associate as part of that, would you say in your view that that, and the board's discussions would indicate that you think that would fall into part of the scope exception that is there today in IFRS 3, but if it's a direct acquisition, it's not in that?
Yes, and therefore as part of the project, because our mandate is pretty much is to look at transactions which are excluded from the scope of IFRS 3. So as part of that, we will see what would be the implications if part of that is acquisition of associates.
So therefore, if, and we obviously see where the discussion goes, but as a minimum of committee members agreed, if we were to finalise the agenda decision, we could make that distinction clear, which I think is what you were suggesting, John?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see an acquisition of an investment in associate as any different from an acquisition of PP&E. If I acquire PP&E in a business combination under common control, I get carryover basis. I should get the same for an investment in an associate, if it's part of a business combination. If it's not, I think we agreed this morning we applied a relevant standard, which to me is IAS 28 and you account for the cost.
But the difference between an equity method investment and a PP&E, and as Reinhard and Andrew mentioned, it is consolidation procedures for the equity method investments. That's the core difference. You don't do a purchase price allocation when you transfer the PP&E under common control. Yeah. I mean, it's really a huge difference, practical difference.
Bruce?
Thank you. I've kind of got a couple of paths to hard answer this, and the first one is, having read the agenda decision, I can see where the staff got to. I mean, there's a way of reading it, and I'll be happy with that. The problem is, the more I read the alternative views, I can definitely see that there's merit in it. And I think that when you listen to the discussions that are happening, we really are nitpicking words and, well, what do we mean by procedure? What do we mean by that? And I think one of the things that came up was, well, hang on, if we're going to go and issue an agenda decision stating that you have to, that you haven't got the exemption, in practice, this could result in a massive issue for people who have been applying it like that, in terms of how would they apply that agenda decision? What are they going to do in terms of that? And I know we've had that discussion, obviously, with the ISA amendment, but we're not there yet, so this is a big challenge for them. So I guess that the answer I've got is I'm not necessarily, I don't like the answer, but I'm not necessarily disagreeing with the agenda decision's got to. My only question is an agenda decision the right answer for it? If we issued this as an interpretation with a prospective application, would this not at least go some of the way to assist people in terms of the fact that we would not have to worry about how you would apply this if you've been doing it the other way?
So actually, I asked yesterday about what would the consequence be of an agenda decision in terms of, you know, if you haven't been doing it this way, what's the practical implications for somebody? And Jabbert?
Yeah, and when we looked at it initially in terms of finalizing the agenda decision and the implications on retrospective application, we didn't think it would be a very big deal in practice. And the reason for that is that the entity who would have to change their accounting would be the one who had probably done the accounting on the predecessor cost basis or something similar. And if they had to go back and change to fair value accounting, it would mean going back in time and determining the fair value. And that would, in a lot of cases, involve the use of hindsight.
If not all.
except, sorry, just to challenge that. I mean, if you'd done an acquisition of something at that stage, even if it was under common control, there's a fair chance you did some sort of due diligence at that point, which means I think your assumption that they haven't got any fair values could be a bit of a leap.
So obviously, in the context of IAS 8, and the reason we're thinking about doing the amendment is it's identified that crossing that impracticability threshold can often be difficult. The one time where I think it's not so difficult, but please correct me if I'm wrong, is I think when it's hindsight. So there's an impracticability threshold, just talks about, you know, it being really difficult to do, but maybe it doesn't involve hindsight. Now, then that's when I think it's an incredibly high threshold. But I think hopefully on a hindsight issue, and particularly when it's an issue where you potentially, in theory, would have to be recreating fair values. And maybe you've done a rough fair value, but, you know, recreating fair value numbers for all of, you know, individual assets and liabilities. I would think that that's where it's less difficult to have to demonstrate that that would be an.
But the first step is to, for a large global multinational, to go through and figure out what the inventory is of even what you have to go look at.
You've done
that step in and of itself could be extremely challenging, because there may have been, for tax reasons, a lot of restructuring of things moving around, may have been part of, you know, a broader group, therefore under IFRS 3, may not have been. But to even go do that assessment, I think, is a lot more work than was contemplated just in two steps down. So if you say, okay, fine, I've got to go get my inventory, then I got to look at everything and say, okay, how many of those might have been under IFRS 3? When were they? Were they 10 years ago, 15 years ago? So from a practical perspective, I think it's a lot more than what you're assuming, before you even get to that impracticability. And if you had a fair value for tax, then you have to go through and prove to the auditors that it's not practical to use that, or you have to use hindsight to do a purchase price allocation for an associate in the past. So this would be a big deal. That's my personal view. This would be a very big deal from a practical perspective.
This would cost people real money.
For no added value or benefit, in my view.
Reduce diversity in application,
except the people are doing.
but if there's enough, I mean, the comment letters indicate that there's diversity in how paragraph 26 is read, and it's not clear, which I think is the point. So if it's unclear, then the point is we need to clarify what this says and how it's interpreted and how it's to be applied. Which, if it's done in a agenda decision, it's going to be a very significant impact from an operational and practical perspective.
Yeah, and I accept all of that, and that's obviously what we're debating, the appropriateness of
right.
that and
Understood.
The clarity of that and all of that. My only point is that, for me, there is a benefit of getting everybody onto the same system. Now, I acknowledge we have to see the cost of that relative to those benefits, but it's not the mode of having everybody applying the requirements the same way.
If I go to my CFO and say I have to spend X amount of
that's right. and that's
internal
the cost
time
for the benefit, but there is a benefit, right?
He's going to roll his eyes.
Yeah, but there's still a benefit. We can't say there's no benefit in reducing diversity when we're on the interpretations committee.
How do you define benefit?
I understand.
maybe let me hold, because mine is kind of at the end.
Just very briefly, I do agree that there is benefit in getting diversity out of the system. I think the question is, how do we best do it in the most practical way? But that's all.
Here it has more to do with the practical consequences
yeah.
I
of the
that.
Principal issue.
I'll do this as a bit of a troublemaker to, I think, almost everybody around the table. So that's a warning. The first people I'm being a troublemaker to is the regulators to my left and to my right. So heads up for you, because certainly on the BizCom under common control, we've had a lot of pressure from the regulators to make more progress with that project, because they have been concerned about the diversity in practice with those transactions, because such transactions often are a prelude to some kind of capital market transaction, be it spin-off, distribution, IPO, et cetera. And we have not done a particularly good job in terms of making progress, which I think is one reason Petrina is so welcoming of Yulia's presence and work on this project. It seems to me that if we do not address the diversity here or confirm it, that we are compounding the problem that we have with, you know, acquisitions of subsidiaries. So I'm challenging and making trouble for you guys by saying I'm a bit surprised that you're sitting silent as we go through this. Do you have any observations to offer from that perspective? But while you think about that, and curse me for making that challenge, I also want to go back to those who support not finalizing, you know, not confirming the analysis in the staff paper and the staff recommendation. And that is to say, this morning, the conclusion was that you do not apply scope exceptions by analogy. And I think then the challenge would be for those who support not moving ahead with differentiating between that decision of not applying scope, you know, exceptions by analogy from the decision here. And that's something that I haven't heard people comment on about why this is different from applying. I mean, it may be implicit in what you said, but can you stand back and report on today's activities in the 3-minute thumbnail sketch and say, we reached this decision in the morning and here's why it's consistent with X decision in the afternoon. So that's my making everybody at the table hate me attempt for late afternoon.
At least I won't be the only one, so that's good.
If I could just respond to Mary's last comment, that's something that when we talked about this internally, we wanted to be very careful that we aren't inconsistent. Mm. And I guess I wasn't very clear in what I was saying. I think there's an acceptable view to say that as a principle, we do not apply scope exceptions by analogy. However, the words in paragraph 26 could be read to imply that you import that guidance, that exception, into IS 28. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about applying that scope exception by analogy. It's really, the view is that you're applying what those words in paragraph 26 could be read to say. Because there's specific words that talk about the acquisition of a subsidiary. It's the second sentence in the paragraph on IS 26 dealing with equity method procedures. The first one talks about, you know, procedures similar to the consolidation procedures in IFRS 10, and then it says, furthermore, the concepts applying underlying procedures and accounting for the acquisition of a sub are adopted and accounting for the acquisition of an investment. And I understand there are some who take the view that that's just saying, reiterating what the first sentence is saying. All I'm saying is there is an acceptable view, or there is a view out there that has been accepted, that IFRIC accepted back in 2013 when it was last discussed, that there's a lack of clarity as to what that means, and it's not necessarily about applying it by analogy.
John, sorry.
I want to challenge what Reinhardt said about not applying it by analogy. IFRS 3 tells you nothing about how to account for business combinations under common control. It scopes them out. So even if paragraph 26 sends you to IFRS 3, IFRS 3 doesn't tell you anything about it. So how can you get, I mean, I don't understand how you can get to IFRS 3 and then say, oh, and I'm now scoped out of IFRS 3. I mean, you're in 28 for the accounting. So even if 26 is telling you to apply the procedures in 3, 3 tells you nothing about the business combinations under common control. So I don't really agree that it's not actually importing an exemption by analogy.
But the scope will determine your accounting for that acquisition, right? So if you're in IFRS 3, it's clear as to what the accounting is. If you're not in IFRS 3, you have to account for the acquisition of the subsidiary in any event.
Yeah.
And so I hear what you're saying, John. I think that is one view. There is another view to say that it's not as clear as that.
And I suppose maybe we as staff at least were lined up with what John was thinking, and that we viewed importantly there talked about the concepts underlying the procedures used in accounting. So those words seem to say this is telling you how you do the accounting. What a scope paragraph does is tell you about the population of transactions to which you apply that accounting. So I understand what you're saying, Reinhardt, but we still thought that indirectly that was picking up the scope exception by analogy, which we sort of said this morning.
Okay, so we're all friends at the end of the day. I think I'm going to wrap this up soon. Jennifer, I'll let you in though.
Yeah, so I appreciate your comments, Mary, but I guess...
I noticed you moved to the right.
But my translation of that is...
no, it's interesting because one of the reasons I was silent was I was really thinking about... So I came in with 2 points, but it ended up being different points than what was discussed around the table. So one was, it was actually back to this point about, it seemed like the last meeting, the committee seemed to think it was important to sort of lay down the marker that, you know, you can't apply a scope exception by analogy. So that seemed to be an important point coming out of the last meeting. But I hadn't thought about, I guess, the point that Reinhardt's now bringing up that, you know, some may consider that to be called into question, at least with respect to IS 28 and IFRS 3, because of when you look at the wording. And I admit, just my own view, this is probably not helping. When I now that we had the, you know, the agenda decision in front of us from 2013, May 2013, I read that also with a little bit of discomfort of thinking, I wonder if that actually maybe caused confusion. I don't know, in the way that it was worded. But I can also hear Bob's point that, well, that, you know, is that more about measurement than scope? And so, you know, don't get confused about kind of what the guidance is for. So I am back to it. I think it'd be good if we could lay down the marker that you don't apply scope exceptions by analogy. So that's one point. The other point I thought would get more discussion is just the paragraph around the, you know, transactions with owners and their capacity as owners and sort of back and forth on that, which we haven't discussed as much. I think some did say to clarify or take it out, but that was one. Admittedly, last meeting I came in prepared to say maybe we should just take that out. There seemed to be a lot of discussion around the table that if you don't include that guidance and companies don't think about that in their transactions, they might end up with misleading results. So as a regulator, of course, I don't want that. But I also appreciate the comment letters on that that say, well, it's not clear how you do that. And so is it better to tell companies you have to do it, figure out how to do it, versus understand there might not be clarity on exactly how that's done. Could there be diversity? But is that better than having companies think they don't have to think about it at all? So don't know the answer to that, but those are just some of the considerations.
Okay, so I'm not going to call a vote on the agenda decision. I think I get the sense from the room. What I think we will do on our side of the table is report back to the board that where we landed in terms of this agenda decision and the fact that I think we do have diversity in practice, and talk to the board about what, if anything, we might need to do in terms of next steps on this topic. I'll just leave it there for the moment. Right, and although I do agree that the discussion about the transactions with owners and their capacity of owners would have been interesting, I think it's interesting in the context of finalising the agenda decision, so I don't know that I've got the energy for that right now.
So, if we don't call a vote on this issue, mm-hmm. what does it mean for issue one in agenda paper four, where we said do not analogize? Well, can we differentiate between this?
I'll say what I think the situation is, and then make sure everybody agrees, because I'm sort of working. It's fair to question me because I'm working on an assumption. I thought this morning we were talking about a sort of straight analogy, that if you've got a standard that applies, you can't come along and overlay an exception for transactions under common control as a sort of general proposition. But I think, and I can sort of see where Reinhardt's logic is to differentiate it, and I think that's what we're relying on, is that some people seem to be reading paragraph 26 and IS 28 as consolidation procedures being broader than just the debits and credits, and taking into account the scope that comes in from that as well. So it's sort of not by analogy, they think it's specifically incorporated into paragraph 26 of IAS 28. So I don't think people are seeing an inconsistency between those. I don't want to reopen our old decision, please.
No, I was going to say, even if we were to agree unanimously that there was a scope exclusion, like in IFRS 3, you wouldn't have to apply it. So it would still be perfectly acceptable to apply.
That's why we've got diversity, isn't it?
No, I know, but in the context of the conversation we had this morning, there wouldn't be a general scope exclusion. You could still apply it. Same way as you can apply IFRS 3 to common control business combinations.
But am I thinking
validate the accounting?
Well, but am I thinking about this wrong? That somebody could come along and say, "Hey, no, agenda paper four. I was going to, because I believe that there's the scope. I can apply the scope exception. That's another paragraph 26. That's another acceptable alternative. I can use carryover basis instead of paragraph 10 cost.
Yeah.
For my investment in my associate." So agenda paper four, you only apply if...
So my point is you'd still be able to do that.
You still can, but you're not required to.
Yeah.
Well, frankly, Tony, I think the decision this morning says there is absolutely no permission to apply a scope exception for the contribution. Yeah. I mean, that was this morning's discussion. You're highlighting that you're not precluded, but I think the discussion this morning confirmed.
I agree that it did, yeah.
That's also the reason why I made the comments. Why I made the comments that I would refer the answer on question A, question one, asked to the members,
yes.
To the discussion around agenda paper 5F, because effectively you might rethink the answer then, or the reasoning behind what was decided this morning. Following today's discussion, agenda paper 5F.
That one has the benefit of going out for comments, so we'll have plenty of opportunity to debate that one again. Yes, it's a tentative agenda decision. You guys have heard. Okay. So that was the end of the specific technical papers.